Boston is one of the few major cities in the United States where it can be legitimately claimed that Irish organized crime groups have historically been as powerful, if not more so, than their Italian counterparts. The first person who comes to mind when people think about the Irish mob in Boston is Whitey Bulger, but there is a lot more to the story prior to him taking over. I'm Brian McCoy. Welcome to the Mob Files. Hello everyone and welcome into episode 5 of the Mob Files. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. New episodes come out every Thursday. Today's episode will be the first one that is not about the Italian-American Mafia. I originally intended this podcast to focus solely on the Mafia, but honestly, there are too many good stories from other organized crime groups out there not to talk about. The vast majority of episodes will still be about the Mafia, but every once in a while we will explore those other groups. And today, our subject is the Irish Mob. The Irish mob doesn't get nearly the same level of attention as the American mafia, and that is completely understandable. Overall, the Irish didn't, and don't, have near the level of power and influence as the Italians. The Irish mob also isn't as organized as the mafia. It consisted primarily of loosely connected street gangs who happened to be Irish. These gangs themselves even consisted of loosely connected members lots of times. Regardless, there are certain Irish figures and groups who gained notoriety in the world of organized crime. Boston was home to several of those groups. And of course, to one of the most infamous criminals in history. The Irish dominated the underworld of Boston for much of the early 20th century, before losing power to the Italians for a period of time. However, the Irish eventually regained their footing and seized power again in the latter half of the century. As I stated a second ago, one of the most famous mobsters in history is an Irishman from Boston. I'm talking, of course, about Whitey Bulger. He is infamous for terrorizing Boston for decades. There will be another episode devoted entirely to Bulger's time and power, but this one will focus on the Irish mob in Boston prior to him taking over the city. We have a lot to discuss, from Prohibition-era rackets to the fight for power between the Irish and Italians, to the famous Boston-Irish gang war. Organized crime has a deep history in Boston. Let's jump in. The first top dog Irish mobster in Boston was Frank Wallace. Wallace grew up in South Boston and made his name there as well. Frank and his brother Steve started operating in Southie in the early 1900s. They formed the Gustin Gang, named for a street in their neighborhood. In its early days, the gang focused on robbing delivery trucks and other forms of theft. But their true calling came after Prohibition started in early 1920. Like countless criminals in the United States, the Wallace brothers saw this as an excellent opportunity. During Prohibition, political connections were key. Gangsters relied on law enforcement looking the other way so they could operate freely. The brothers understood this and had built relationships with the right people. There were other Irish gangs in Boston at this time, but the Wallace brothers rose to the top. Their top competition actually didn't come from these other Irish gangs. As you might have been able to guess, the Italians were not thrilled with Wallace being so powerful. To make things worse, the Italians believed that Wallace was responsible for hijacking some of their beer shipments. Fearing an all-out war, Wallace agreed to a sit-down with the Italians from North Boston in December of 1931. Unfortunately, the meeting was not set up in good faith. Wallace and his right-hand man, Bernard Walsh, were murdered when they arrived. This marked a changing of the guard in terms of control of crime in Boston. The Italians had eliminated their key competitor, and this allowed them to take control of the city for the next 3 decades. The Irish gangs didn't disappear after Wallace's death. They were still around and still operating, just in a much smaller way. This changed when the Winter Hill Gang rose to prominence in the late 1950s. The Winter Hill Gang was originally led by James Buddy McLean. McLean was born in 1930 in Somerville, which is a suburb of Boston. He quickly built up a reputation as a street brawler. Along with Joseph McDonald, he built up a group of loyal followers in Somerville in the mid to late 1950s, and they would need this manpower in the coming years. The other prominent Irish gang in Boston at this time was the McLaughlin brothers in Charlestown. The McLaughlin brothers, consisting of Bernie, Georgie, and Edward Punchy McLaughlin, operated in the Boston neighborhood of Charlestown. Bernie was the leader of the crew. He was born in 1921 in Boston, and prior to starting the gang with his brothers, Bernie was a greatly feared enforcer for the mafia in Boston. He was well known for his brutal tactics when collecting debt, including snapping arms and legs. At some point in the 50s, the McLaughlin brothers decided to branch out and work independent of the mafia. They still did a lot of work for other groups, including the Italians, and even their future rivals, the Winter Hill Gang. But the good times didn't last forever. they would soon be ensnared in a bloody war with Winter Hill. The war was sparked late in the summer of 1961. On September 4th, members of both the Winter Hill Gang and the McLaughlins were at a party together. Georgie McLaughlin started hitting on one of the Winter Hill associates' girlfriends. This obviously didn't go over very well, and McLaughlin was severely beaten by a group of Winter Hill members. Bernie McLaughlin wanted to take revenge on behalf of his brother, but had the good sense to approach Buddy McLean about it first. McLaughlin wanted McLean to discipline those responsible or get permission to do it himself, but McLean refused and stuck up for his guys. He basically told McLaughlin, "Look, your guy was out of line, and my people responded appropriately." Obviously, McLaughlin disagreed with this assessment and was pissed off. Shortly thereafter, McLean caught men trying to set up a car bomb on one of the vehicles outside of his house. His wife had heard noises and asked him to check it out. He came outside with a pistol and opened fire on the men, scaring them off. When he inspected the car, he found dynamite taped to the ignition switch. McLean was enraged and decided to retaliate. On October 30th, 1961, McLean and two associates, including police officer Russ Nicholson, waited for Bernie McLaughlin outside of one of his hangouts, the Morning Glory Cafe in Charlestown. When McLaughlin exited the cafe, McLean walked up behind him and shot him in the back of the head. There were dozens of witnesses who saw exactly what happened, but Charlestown, like many neighborhoods, had a code of not speaking to law enforcement, and so charges against McLean were never able to stick. Obviously, the McLaughlins wanted revenge. Their preferred target was Buddy McLean himself, but he was in prison on weapons charges shortly after the shooting. They took what they could get and killed George Joint, a McLean associate, in 1961. In 1964, Georgie McLaughlin, who had recovered from his previous attack, shot another McLean associate at a party. McLaughlin was eventually convicted for this murder. This could have been something of a blessing in disguise for Georgie, as it allowed him to actually survive the gang war. Later in 1964, Russ Nicholson, again who was the cop who had been involved in the Bernie McLaughlin hit, was murdered by Punchy and Georgie McLaughlin. Also in 1964, the bodies of two McLaughlin associates were found in Boston Harbor. There was evidence that the McLeans had tortured them before they were killed. The Irish controlled a lot of the day-to-day rackets in Boston in the 1960s, but that didn't mean the Italians weren't involved too. The Patriarca family ran crews in Boston and also down in Rhode Island. Raymond Patriarca was boss of the family, but his voice on the streets in Boston was his underboss Jerry Angiulo. The Italians viewed the Irish as a valuable asset. They could put the Italians' money on the street and run other rackets for them in Boston. Having these two gangs at war was bad for their business. Patriarca eventually put his foot down and ordered a truce in 1965. One of his top captains tried to negotiate this, but it didn't work out well. The war continued and the Italians had to choose sides. They chose to put their support behind the Winter Hill Gang and Buddy McLean. In October 1965, Edward Punchy McLaughlin was shot and killed, allegedly by Stephen Fleming, who went on to become a very prominent mobster in Boston. Around the same time, Georgie McLaughlin was put on trial for the murder at the party I talked about earlier. He was convicted and sent away. At this point, all of the McLaughlin brothers were out of the picture. Two were dead, and one was in jail. Up to that point, there was no doubt the McLeans had fared much better in the war. The McLaughlin's leadership had been decimated. However, the McLeans suffered a huge blow just 10 days after Punchy McLaughlin was killed. On October 30th, 1965, Buddy McLean was ambushed by Stevie and Connie Hughes. McLean survived long enough to make it to the hospital but died 2 days later. The Hughes brothers were McLaughlin associates known for carrying out hits for the gang. The shooting could have been simply out of revenge for Punchy's death, or it could have been because the Hughes brothers saw an opportunity to continue the war and take out the Winter Hill Gang for personal gain. If they thought taking out McLean would mean a quick end to the war, they were mistaken. In November 1965, several more McLaughlin associates were killed. This had been an extremely bloody year in Boston, but the carnage was far from over. The Hughes brothers had taken over the Charlestown mob after the McLaughlin brothers were out of the picture. Their reign did not last long. In May of 1966, Connie Hughes was driving home late at night when two cars pulled up on either side of his and opened fire. He was killed instantly. Stevie Hughes had to know he was in grave danger at this point, but he stayed active on the streets of Boston anyway. In September 1966, he was killed in the same manner as his brother. He was driving home, and a vehicle pulled up next to him and opened fire. Hughes and his associate, Sammy Lindenbaum, who happened to be riding with him at the time, were both killed. Stevie Hughes' death effectively ended the war between the McLean Winter Hill Gang and the McLaughlin Charlestown Gang. The McLaughlins had been decimated by the war. Two of the brothers had been killed, and the third only survived due to the safety of his prison cell. Winter Hill also suffered significant losses, but the gang survived. And as you will hear soon, they did more than that. After Buddy McLean's death, Winter Hill needed a new leader. Buddy's right-hand man, Howie Winter, was selected. Winter was born in Boston in 1929. He had been close friends with both Buddy McLean and Joseph McDonald, the original founders of the gang. It was plausible that either McDonald or Winter could have taken the top job after Buddy's death, but it was ultimately decided that Winter would do so. McDonald remained a vital member of the gang. For the next couple of decades, the Winter Hill Gang was a potent force in the Boston underworld. In the late 60s and early 70s, the gang was primarily focused on loan sharking and protection rackets. They were a violent group of criminals, so it wasn't hard to get businesses or truck drivers to pay them protection fees. Again, this often meant protection from them just as much as it meant protection from other criminal groups. The gang built up a large roster of criminals during this time. This includes Johnny Martirano. Martirano was half Italian, half Irish, but grew up in an Irish neighborhood. He would become one of the Winter Hill Gang's top enforcers and hitmen, with at least 20 murders to his name. It also includes Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy, who you heard a little about earlier, and who would go on to become Whitey Bulger's top guy, and also an FBI informant. And of course, the roster also included one of the most famous mobsters in history, James Whitey Bulger. Martirano and Flemmy will be covered in detail in the upcoming Whitey Bulger episode. Bulger hadn't always been aligned with the Winter Hill Gang. Prior to joining forces with them, he was associated with Donald Killeen, who, starting in the 1940s, ran loan sharking and bookmaking operations in Southie along with his brothers Edward, George, and Kenneth. The Mullen Gang, another Irish group, also operated in South Boston in the 50s through the 70s. This group was comprised primarily of loosely associated but talented thieves. With both groups operating in the same neighborhood, it didn't take long for conflict to arise. Things erupted in 1971 when Kenny Killeen bit the nose off of a Mullen Gang member. A few weeks later, Killeen member shot and paralyzed Mullen associate Dennis Buddy Roach. At this point, the Killeens were winning the war, but it wasn't sustainable. The Mullens had tons of members, somewhere around 60, and the Killeens simply didn't have the manpower to compete. Donald Killeen was shot and killed on May 13, 1972 outside of his home. At this point, Whitey Bulger fled Boston. It's not hard to see why. He was pretty much second in command in that gang, so it was obvious that the Mullens would turn their sights onto him with Killeen out of the picture. Somehow, the dispute actually ended amicably after Howie Winter was appointed to mediate a peace agreement between the two gangs. Under the agreement, they would all be united and work under the umbrella of the Winter Hill Gang. Winter named Bulger the head of operations in South Boston shortly thereafter. In the late 70s, the leaders of the Winter Hill Gang were having money problems. Their usual rackets weren't bringing in enough cash, so they decided to turn to new areas, specifically rigging horse races and drug trafficking to try and supplement their income. This backfired, and most of the top members of the gang were convicted for rigging the races in 1979. This includes Howie Winter, meaning that there was now an opening at the top of the gang. Whitey Bulger and Stephen Flemmy had managed to avoid conviction and took over the gang. This was the beginning of Whitey Bulger's reign of terror in Boston. As I stated in the intro, Bulger overshadows other criminals in Boston's history, and this is especially true of the Irish mob heavyweights who came before him. He is certainly the most powerful gangster in the city's history, but a lot of important events took place before he took things over. Thank you for listening to episode 5 of The Mob Files. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe, and if you are listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave a review. Thanks again, and have a great day.